Welcome to Turning 59. I'm Dr. Pete, and these are my stories. When I was little, I was a misfit. I had flaming red hair, a freckled face, and buck teeth, along with a blazing temper. I was the brunt of every joke. I was bullied in the classrooms and I was bullied in the schoolyards. By the time I was 10, I'd been dragged to the principal's office by every means available. By my hair, by my ears, by my shirt collar, and probably a few ways that I can't think of right now. And so it was that my parents decided to send me to a summer camp in Wyoming in the summer of 1969. And when I set foot into the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming, where I learned to rock climb, I never looked back. It was the beginning of a 40-year career of mountaineering and rock climbing. So grab a hold of your saddle horn and hang on, because this is going to get intense, and I hope that you enjoy the stories that I'm about to tell. My first bivvy on the side of a cliff happened in the summer of 1970. Now, just in case the listener doesn't understand what bivvy means, it's short for bivouac, and a bivouac is a temporary encampment. Now, in 1970, I was 12 years old, and it was the second year that I had the opportunity to go to summer camp in Wyoming. Now, when I say summer camp in Wyoming, this probably brings back memories for a lot of people to these wonderful days, you know, in the pines where they're playing capture the flag and bobbing for apples and things like that. But this summer camp was a little bit different than that sort of experience. This was 57 miles up dirt roads into the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming. And back in those days, Roland Ryan and Jim Mines were running a camp for kids that basically did two things. It focused on horseback riding and on mountaineering. Now, the very first week that I was up there in the summer of 1969, I went through a program called Base Camp. And Base Camp basically was a program where you spent half of the day learning horsemanship and you spent half the day at the crag learning how to rock climb. What I want the listeners to understand, though, about this was that in those days, the type of instruction that we had was fairly hardcore. For example, in terms of the horsemanship, the horses that we were working with had literally been caught on the range earlier that spring on the high plains of the western slopes of the Wind River Mountains. And so these horses were green broke. And just about every kid who was in this program in the course of that 1 week had been bucked off their horse at least once. I know that I had. And one of the most terrifying things that happens when these horses go to bucking is that they go tearing into the woods and you're hanging onto the horn of the saddle and you've got limbs and branches that are raking across your shoulders. It's a really scary thing. The climbing, on the other hand, resembled nothing that you see in this day and age in 2017. I mean, in 2017, most people are learning how to climb in a gym with a nice cushy floor where they learn the figure eight knot. They've got automatic belay systems, or they're trained how to use one of these automatic braking systems like the Grigri. It pales in comparison to what we learned way back in 1969 and 1970, because back then we were still using twisted nylon ropes, the gold line and white lines, for example. Perlon, if it had been invented, it wasn't ubiquitous, and people were not actually using it much yet. The standard modes of protection were still pitons, for example, none of the clean gear that you see around these days, the nuts and chocks and automatic camming devices, none of that stuff was available. And even the sling gear, the nylon webbing was crude compared to what is available now. And so in terms of the climbing, we learned how to do around the hip belays. We learned how to do body rappels. We learned how to make figure eight Swiss seats for the rappelling and so on our own. We learned how to tie, I don't know, it must have been something like 8 or 10 different knots, the water knot, ring bends, the bowline, butterflies, all these different knots we learned. And when we went climbing on the cliffs, basically we used a round hip belays. So one guy would go to the top of the cliff, you would sit down and brace your feet against an edge, throw the other end over the side, your buddy would tie in at the bottom with a bowline on the loop around their waist, and then they would go for the route. And the thing about that is that, number one, if the person belaying didn't know what they were doing, you were going to get dropped. And more than one person in those days, I can tell you right now, got dropped on their ass. The other thing is that when you fall off a route with a bowline around the waist, it hurts. It hurts a lot. It's not like this day and age where you've got these nice cushy harnesses where putting your weight on the rope is relatively a comfortable endeavor compared to taking a fall with literally a bowline around your waist. So in the summer of 1969, which was my first summer at this camp at Johnson Lake in the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming, I had split my days between the horsemanship and the rock climbing. And at 11 years old, for whatever reason, I sort of aligned myself with the climbing. I liked to do it. And the thing that made this really special for me was the fact that I was so small. I mean, you know, I must have weighed at that point in 11 years old. I probably still weighed under 100 pounds. I was a scrawny kid. I had buck teeth, flaming red hair. Back home in Illinois, I was relentlessly bullied because of the way I looked, and I had a blazing temper for which the kids back in Illinois seemed to know all the right buttons to push. When I was in Wyoming and when I was rock climbing at the crags, I was good at this. I discovered later because I could deal with the pain. I could deal with hanging on the bowline around the waist, and I learned that the only thing that was required to be successful on the climbs there was the willingness to hang on until you got to the top, and I got really good at that. So in 1970, the opportunity came to me at 12 years old to do what was called the Advanced Mountaineering, and of course I signed up for it. I was by far, I think, the youngest student of the bunch. There was maybe 8 or 10 of us. Roland had a kid from Colorado. His name, I believe, was Jim Rippey. And I think that he was in the age range of around 16 or 17. And he actually had more climbing experience than Roland did. In any case, we threw backpacks on and hiked up to Big Sandy Lake and put in a base camp there. And over the course of 5 or 6 days, we climbed a bunch of the major peaks that are around in that area. One of the things that we did was we went over Jackass Pass and we climbed Pingora, which we spent something like 13 hours on, which was an outrageous amount of time to have spent on a climb. Quite frankly, we didn't really know what we were doing. This was the southwest face of Pingora, and anyone who's climbed in the Cirque of the Towers knows that route is like, we call it easy fifth class. It's not very difficult. The fact that it took us that long to do it happened because we utterly did not know what we were doing. We were learning literally by the seat of our pants. So in any case, after that climb, we ended up back at Big Sandy Lake and we rested up there for maybe a day or so. And then we moved our camp up to Clear Lake. And the objective at Clear Lake was to climb this mountain called Haystack. And so we got up at 3:30 in the morning. We all carried a small knapsack. We had, you know, water and some snacks in there, our poncho and so on. This was in the age before headlamps, so we worked our way up through the forest in the dark and then eventually went up to the north shoulder. And the actual north ridge of Haystack Peak is a relatively easy route. There's only one little section on it, which is maybe 60 feet long, which is relatively low angle, real clean granite. But it's the only place on the climb where you actually have to rope up. And if I remember right, I'm pretty certain that Jim Rippey led that section and that he went ahead and belayed the rest of us up, and then Roland followed. And right there's an alcove where we basically stashed all of the gear. And then there is a gully above that, and we all lined out in that gully and eventually went to the summit of Haystack. Haystack was a success for us. We made it back to camp that day, I would say probably sometime around 11 a.m. Most of us disappeared into our tents, me included, and took a nap, because like I said, we'd gotten up at 3:30 in the morning to climb that thing. So it might have been sometime around 2 in the afternoon when I was sitting outside my tent with another student, and honestly, I can't remember his name, but we were in the course of eating some food when Roland appeared, and he said, "Hey, you guys, we're going to go climb another peak." Now, given our level of experience and the amount of training that we had all had, starting another mountain climb at 2 in the afternoon was probably one of the most serious mistakes that we made on that trip. In fact, when you hear the rest of the story, you know it's going to be the worst of the mistakes. But, you know, I was only 12 years old, and I think most of the other students that were involved on this trip were older than me, but we were all fairly young. I think that Rippey was probably the oldest one of all the kids, and he was 16. So none of us really raised any objections about this. And I would say that probably by 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon, we were wandering across the valley headed towards a mountain that's called Mount Schistler. Now, Mount Schistler, on its own merit, is not that big a deal of a peak. Like these days, I wouldn't think anything of like running up that sucker, and you'd probably be at the top within maybe an hour or something like that. But again, this was 1970. This was a group of people that really knew nothing about climbing other than the basics. So we packed our bags and we hiked across the valley to Mount Schistler. In the process of getting to the base of Mount Schistler, we had to circumvent a large granite dome. If you're ever up in this country, there's a big knob, granite knob, that sits between Clear Lake and Rapid Lake, and we had to work our way around that. And once we did and we popped out in the valley that is literally at the base of Schistler, we found ourselves in the city of tents. And it turned out that the Chicago Mountaineers were there, and there must have been, I think they said that there was something like maybe 80 or 100 participants that were camped in this valley. In any case, we ran into this woman who calmly asked us what we were doing as we were hiking in a line, you know, literally through their campsite. And Roland offered the fact that we were going to go climb, you know, Schistler, and he pointed at the top of the peak from where we were standing. And she pointed out to him, "Isn't it a little late in the day, don't you think, to be starting up a mountain?" And of course, Roland responded like, "No, it's fairly short. There's only like one pitch of climbing." And again, for the listeners that don't know anything about climbing, one pitch is like maybe 160 feet of climbing in this case back in that day, maybe 150 actually, because ropes, I don't think, were much longer than 150 in those days. But in any case, we said, "Yeah, that's what we're going to do." And so we went on and we started working our way up through the boulder fields there. And eventually we came to this section of cliff that didn't seem very long to me, but it's where it was pretty steep. And it's where Roland and Rippey decided they were going to give this thing a shot. So Rippey starts leading up this with a bowline tied around his waist. And remember, this is the age of pitons and whatnot. So he's got a piton hammer. He's got several knife blades and billabongs and other types of pitons, you know, strapped to his waist. And he starts up this thing and he hammers in a couple of pins. And he gets up maybe 10 or 15 feet above a cluster of these pins and he falls off this thing. And he takes this pretty long fall. I mean, this is like probably a 30 or 40 footer. Roland catches him using a round the hip belay of all things, right? And Rippey is really, really shaken up, as is we all are. We've just witnessed this, you know, blood screaming fall off this cliffside. And so they make the decision, okay, we're going to pull that rope and we'll find another way, right? So we pull the rope down, they leave the pins in that are up there in a carabiner or whatever. And so we start up these ramps. Well, eventually the ramps sort of zigzag and we bust out onto the summit ridge of Schistler just as the last vestiges of light are fading from the day. But worse than that, you can see this horrendous storm that's coming at us from the west. It's just this massive thundercloud with a flat black bottom, and there's lightning, and you can see the rain extending all the way out into the plains, and this is moving at us. So now all of a sudden, Roland and Rippy are feeling very motivated to get to the summit and to get down, all right? So they take off running for the summit. Now, anyone who really knows about climbing and you hear what I just said, you should see the red flags, because basically the smart thing to do right then and there would have been to turn around and go down. But that's not what we did. Like if I was I wouldn't have been guiding that. So let's just try to stay on track here. So they take off for the summit, which is probably maybe about 100 yards above us, with this storm that's just beating a path to us at that point. And of course, I'm the smallest one of the bunch, so I follow these guys and I'm going as fast as I can. But man, I'm small and I've got short legs, and we're at 12,000 feet and I'm puffing like there's no tomorrow in this deal, right? And I fall behind. And I know that there was another young guy too, and I don't remember his name, but he was back there with me too, but I was last of the last. And as we're going up there, the thunder, you know, starts to clap all around us. It's getting very, very dark, and there's very bright flashes of lightning, and now you can feel the rain, which is being blown in horizontal out of the west. And I see the guys ahead of me, they hit the summit, and they turn around and they start running down. And as soon as they got past me, I turned around and just followed them. I didn't care about the summit. All I cared about was staying with the group, because at this point I did not want to get lost. And so we start down this thing, but a lot of things happened at once. And you've got to realize that at this point, because this was so late in the evening when we finally topped out on the summit ridge, because I guess it took us several hours to work up those ledges before we finally got to the summit ledge or the summit ridge. Now it's dark. And the only light that we have is in the lightning flashes. For a second, you can see everything that's happening on the ridge, and then it goes dark again. So we automatically started slowing down. And I literally can remember putting one hand on the guy in front of me and hoping that the guy in front of me didn't lose track of who was in front of him. And this is how we went. Somehow, we completely missed the turn that we needed to make in order to zigzag our way back down to the valley, which held Rapid Lake. And we continued along this summit ridge going down it. Eventually, we get to a point where we literally ledge out on this thing, and we can't see what we're standing atop of. However, by this time, it is pouring rain. We've got lightning that is blasting down all around us. You've got yellowish blue arcing that's going on between the carabiners that we have on our waist and the chains on our canteens. We have these silly, you know, military tin canteens that we're carrying, and you know, this ancient prehistoric gear that we have all over us. None of us are dressed appropriately for this. We're wearing ponchos over Levi jackets and t-shirts, and we've come to this place where we can no longer go down. And the lightning literally is flashing along with the simultaneous bang of the thunder. And we all are kind of crouching and leaning down and kneeling in incredibly wet conditions. And Roland gets the idea that, well, we're on the edge of something, so we'll throw a rope down, and Jim Rippey will wrap down this thing and see, you know, hopefully come to a ledge. So Rippey goes on rappel, and we have actually in the group one little pen light that now he is holding in his mouth. And so you can see this light kind of bobbing. And then all of a sudden the light disappears. And you hear this bloodthirsty scream. And all I could think of was that fucking Rippy's dead. He has just fallen off this cliff. And again, we can't see what we're looking at. It's jet black. All we know is that the rope is hanging straight down the side of something. And the listener needs to remember that we're using a body rappel. So literally, Rippy's not attached to anything. He's just wrapped in the rope. But literally, a second later, all of a sudden, he appears out of the murk, hand over handing on the line. And somehow, even when he became unwrapped from it, he managed not to fall out of it by some miracle of miracles. And so he pulls back onto the ledge. Roland has got him in his arms. We've got the lightning is flashing and then going away. And now we're frantic, right? So Roland pulls up the rope and he coils it. And we notice that there's a ledge system that bends to the left. If we're facing out over the wall, this thing bends to the left. So what do? We start down this ledge system. And we're working our way down this ledge system and we zigzag back and forth. In certain places, we actually have to climb down from one ledge to another. And we don't use any ropes in this area. I don't to this day know how we managed to do this without somebody falling off and literally tumbling to their death. But we did manage to do this. In one place, we had another guy with us, an adult. His name was Louis Bardo, and he was there. He didn't have any experience either. He didn't know any more about climbing than any of the kids did. We came to this one section where, again, we had to climb down to another ledge, and Rippy led the way. And I will never forget there was a flash of lightning that illuminated where we were. I could see Louis Bardo in that instant, hanging on to this massive rock as it tipped off the cliff. And then the flash was gone and we were back to the inky darkness. And I heard a scream and you could hear this thump and the pounding of this rock as it smashed its way down the cliffside all the way to the bottom of these cliffs that we were now trapped on. And then there was another flash of lightning and I could see Bardo on the ledge below. So somehow he had managed to let go of this rock and had not himself been tossed off the ledge. So again, we all somehow managed to get down that section, but that was actually the end of it. We found ourselves on a ledge that maybe was 2 feet wide, and we sort of bent back to the right actually, and we went along that until all of us were sort of like against the back wall of this thing. And that's when Roland decided that we had to just stop and we just had to bivouac in place. Remember, all we've got are ponchos and Levi jackets and t-shirts, and we're soaking wet. It is snow mixed with rain at this point. The storm is just crashing down on us with lightning and thunder. And so we lay down in this mush of frozen, you know, of slush, basically. And I'll never forget where I knelt down. There was a small pine tree that was growing, and I grabbed a hold of that with both of my hands. I put my lips against it, and I tasted the bark with my tongue, and I swore to myself that no matter what happened, I was not going to let go of that tree. And then we all sort of settled in. We all sort of settled in there snuggling, right? This is like the bivouac from hell. It's the first one that I will do in my career. And it's the one that educated me about how bivouacs are. They're utterly miserable. We all like clustered together. We hugged as best we could. And then we shivered. And we moaned. And we just hung on. And in a bivvy like that, I learned that what you end up doing, the best thing to do is get on your hands and knees. Well, not on your actual hands. You actually like get on your elbows, because that way, and you rest your head right in the dirt. That way you manage to keep the surface area of your body minimized against the cold ground. And you can actually sleep in that position occasionally. Most of the time though, you just sit there and shiver. And every once in a while, you open an eyeball and you peer out hoping to see the light of day. Now, I need to tell the listener, I am not a religious person, but on bivouacs like that, I definitely pray to God and I tell him, I will do anything from this time on for the rest of my life. I'll stop swearing. I won't say fuck anymore. I'll do whatever I have to do if you let me live, right? And so this is the way the night goes until finally you see the sky begin to brighten and you watch it and you hope and you pray and you like, you're dragging the sun up with your will. You want the sun to get up there. And then finally it's light enough to move and we all get up. We're still wet and it's freezing cold. Everyone is visibly shaking. You know, I can't see myself because I don't have a mirror, but I'm looking at these guys who are looking at me and their lips are blue and their teeth are chattering. And we saw where we were at this point in first light for the first time. And we were trapped atop a cliff that was at least 600 or 700 feet tall. There was no choice at all. We had to go back up. It's one of the most depressing moments in my entire climbing career, realizing that after how badly we fought to go down, that we had to turn around and go back up. So we went back up. And we climbed until we finally found a place where we could traverse around this cliff system. And then we went all the way back down to the bottom of the mountain. However, we ended up coming off of Mount Schistler on completely the wrong side relative to where our camp was located. So we found ourselves at the base of this mountain trapped by the river that flows out of the Big Sandy Lake. And so insult to injury, we had to wade this freezing river in order to get across to the other side. And then we made our way around Big Sandy Lake. We made our way back up the trail to Clear Lake. And finally, we got to our tent. And what I remember is just disrobing at my tent. I remember standing there and literally just taking off my clothes until I was bare-ass naked. And then I went inside the tent. I crawled inside my down bag and I went to sleep. And I don't think I woke up until the next day when the sun was on my tent. And I crawled out and I made breakfast. The one thing that I knew after I had done that was that I was a different person. I knew, even though in my young mind at 12 years old, that I had done something that none of the kids my age back in Chicago had ever done and probably would ever do. And for me, it was a life-changing event because when I went back home at the end of that particular summer and I was sitting in a classroom where I was ostracized again for having pale skin and flaming red hair and buck teeth, I knew for the first time in my life that it didn't matter what these kids thought of me. I realized that I was tough, that I had done some things that none of those guys would probably ever do as long as they were alive. And from that moment on, climbing became the central point in my life. It was something that I had to do. I had become a climber and I could never, ever, as far as I could tell at that age, ever give it up. And I remember counting on my fingers at that point at 12 years old, how many times I could go back to the Wind Rivers before I was 18. I know that that sounds completely irrational, but that's what I did. First episode of Turning 59, Bivouac from Hell. I would like to thank you for listening from the bottom of my heart. It has been an honor and a privilege to tell this story, so thank you. More stories can be found at www.boomer-100.com. Stay tuned for the next episode from Turning 59. Please join me in the future for another harrowing adventure in the mountains. This is Dr. Pete, signing off.